welcome to this week's episode of Aquadocs, the podcast that keeps you up to date on all things aquatic medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Michelle Greenfield-Feig. On this week's episode, I have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Jay Sweeney, co-owner and chief veterinarian of Dolphin Quest. On this episode, we follow Dr. Sweeney's journey over his long career as he helped to develop new aspects of the field of aquatic veterinary medicine. It's been an absolute pleasure working with and learning from Dr. Sweeney in person, so I hope you all learned something today as well. So let's get started. Hi, Jay. Welcome to Aquadocs.
Thank you, Michelle, for inviting me. I have been impressed with your lineup of previous guests. So many are friends of mine, so I'm really happy to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited. Why don't you start out by how you got started in the field of marine mammal medicine?
Well, it goes back to childhood. My mother was the first woman marine biologist at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. I was a three-year-old at that time. I fished on the pier. I surfed. I wound up being a makeshift commercial fisherman with another buddy at age 13 and 14, diving. I really made a lifetime of working around the ocean. And it was quite natural that in vet school, I was happy to meet the then veterinarian at SeaWorld, right when SeaWorld was new. It was in 1965. He right then invited me to come spend time at SeaWorld as an intern, which ultimately I did two summers in a row. So that's how I got involved. And I was very lucky. The Navy Dolphin program moved into San Diego right my graduation time. And I knew some of the people in the Navy program from vet school at University of Pennsylvania. And the time was right. And I took a job at the Navy program.
And tell me more about your start with the Navy's Marine Mammal Program.
I was hired at the U.S. Navy program in San Diego as a clinical researcher. My job was to develop diagnostic methods, handling methods, new treatments to increase the lifespan and viability of Navy dolphins and sea lions. And I published those as well. IAAAM, International Association of Aquatic Animal Mammals, had just begun then, and I was then giving presentations there, as well as IMATA, International Marine Animal Trainers Association. And so very quickly, actually, I was asked by aquariums and marine parks all around the world to help them with their animals. And the Navy was happy to have me do that to gain more clinical experience, which was a benefit to the Navy. And so very quickly, I began consulting along with doing my research duties at the Navy.
What were some of those research topics that you were focusing on at that time?
All diagnostics. I mean, there was very little known at the time about advanced methods. There was no ultrasound. There was very little x-rays or radiographs with animals at that time. The problems of access, I mean, these animals are, of course, in the water, and they're not like taking your dog or cat to the veterinarian. You take your dog or cat, veterinarian does diagnostics, does some treatment, and sends your animal home. That doesn't happen, of course, with marine animals. And so a lot of work was done to develop better, more efficient, and easier methods of achieving diagnostic information with these animals. That's what we did with dolphins, sea lions, and as well, we did work with sea lions on the Channel Islands. And so we became quite diverse in the experiences that we were achieving there with the Navy program. I was hired at the Navy in 1971 and worked with the Navy program until 1977. Because I was involved in consulting, very quickly, I was the only guy around who was available and had new expertise in diagnostics and treatments. And so I was in high demand as a consultant. And pretty soon I was doing a full-time consulting practice as well. So as 1977 rolled around, I couldn't be doing both the Navy research and the consulting. And so I went off on my own consulting, and I consulted until 1990 when we developed Dolphin Quest, and I was able to focus on Dolphin Quest for the rest of my career up to the present.
Thank you for catching me up on your background. You've been in this field for a really long time. So where would you like this conversation to go next?
Well, let's talk about the evolution of disease, because it's obvious that diseases progress to some elevated level, which winds up being either fatal or the patient recovers in time, generally a long period of time with great difficulty. However, the talk today is really about early diagnosis. And quite obviously, disease has a beginning. And that beginning is a so-called a soft beginning. It gets worse and worse and worse over time. But in the first few time frames of disease, it's just getting started. The mammalian body has defense mechanisms, and there's a fight between the defense mechanisms and the disease. And the disease, although it makes progress, so to speak, takes a while to do that. And symptoms become available. Even very minor symptoms are apparent in the dolphin in our case. And if those can be recognized, and if we have diagnostic access and ways and methods of sample collecting and laboratory analyses, we can intervene with veterinary skills at the beginning stages of disease development. And we can become far more effective in eliminating the disease when we get to it in an early diagnostic situation. The emphasis that I want to make for this is early diagnosis. Early diagnosis is a priority to the veterinarian, but ultimately the primary challenge in dealing with marine mammals from a veterinary point of view is access. Starting with the 1960s, as I said, I was at SeaWorld as an intern in 1969. At that time, in order to get access to an animal for treatment, we had to either test them with a net or remove the water from the tank. In virtually all cases, takes a long time to instrument. Mind you, the animal was having some sort of difficulty. Back in those days, vets weren't called until it was necessary. Vets were not generally employed by institutions, although there were exceptions. SeaWorld was one. But in any case, the time from the call to the veterinarian was generally a significant amount of time. And the symptoms were obvious and broad. Disease was advanced, and that makes for very difficult application of treatment remedies. This was not favorable to the long-term viability of many animals. And something that I noted in my consulting experience, and we began to make changes to the whole relationship between the veterinarian trainers and management. The main part of that was that I was consulting for an institution called Marineland at the Pacific. And I bring this up because Marineland was a very special place in the 80s and had a staff and curators and management who were very receptive to allowing trainers and veterinary students to come to the institution and experience training, medical procedures, husbandry management, and all things that had to do with early diagnosis advances.
So when you're talking about early diagnoses and advances, what were some of the key differences that changed from when you first started to how it is today?
That's an important question because in the 60s and 70s, trainers were very secretive about how they trained their show behaviors that they put together for institutions. As AMADA provided opportunities for trainers to get together, IAAAM provided opportunities for veterinarians to converse on their experiences. This sense of secretive methodologies began to be broken down. And it was especially so at Marineland. Trainers began to share their experiences. Trainers began to interact more with the animals, and they began developing what are called medical behaviors. This was new at the time, except for the fact that institutions that had killer whales, for example, so that would be SeaWorld and Marineland, you can't very well drop the water level of a killer whale enclosure without taking a great deal of time and losing a great deal of water. They trained those killer whales to provide their tail flukes for blood sampling. Well, that was really a breakthrough in terms of diagnostic applications in killer whales, but it was just killer whales at the time up until about 1980. There was a that I'd like to tell about a pilot whale at Marineland that was named Bubbles, and Bubbles was quite a character. And at the time, we had to remove water from the tank every time we wanted to take a blood sample from Bubbles. Bubbles was very smart. She was very big. She was 20 feet long or thereabouts. And as the tank water level dropped down, She would lay on the drain of the tank. There was only one drain in that tank, and she would lay on it to prevent the water from going out. Didn't prevent the water from going out completely, but ultimately it took a long time for the water to be removed. And Bubbles was ultimately in, at best, a foot of water. Bubbles knew exactly what was going on. I would try to get a sample from her fluke. No way. Bubbles splashed and back and forth, and there was no way that she was rendering her fluke available to me to take a blood sample. Same for her pectoral flippers. That could take a sample from there. I would go there and she would wiggle her flipper this way and wiggle it that way. And it would take forever to get a sample from her because she was just not having any part of it. So we had a meeting with the trainers, and the trainer says, well, come back in 2 weeks for Bubbles and we'll see what we can do. 2 weeks later, we came back to Bubbles and there she was laying in a full tank of water. And I said, well, what are you doing? And they said, just wait. They made a sign with their hand and Bubbles turned over, put her fluke up, and they took a blood sample right there and then. And that was, aside from killer whales, the only cetacean that I was aware of ever having done a medical behavior for trainers. That was the beginning of medical behaviors in the community. The trainers at Marineland presented this case at AMADA, and I presented at IAAAM. And from then, there was an explosion of training, not only in training animals for medical behaviors, but in communication back and forth between veterinarians, trainers, and management, where medical behaviors became a must. It became typical of every animal healthcare team, and it was a terrific advance in early diagnostic of these animals. And over time, medical behaviors included all kinds of diagnostic procedures, not just blood samples, gastric samples, fecal samples, blow samples, skin samples, biopsies of all kinds, all were and are done under behavioral control with animals, and they're happy to do it.
It's really funny to hear you share that story because I'm sitting here graduating from vet school this year, and I've grown up in a world where medical behaviors are standard. Taking a blood sample on a tail fluke, yeah, it's so obvious. Of course, they're going to be trained to do that and they're participating in their own medical care. It's such a standard now. So it's kind of crazy, but also exciting to hear you talk about like, hey, I helped develop what is pretty much the standard of how we manage these animals now. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, medical behaviors are standard best practices for veterinarians throughout the marine mammal parks and aquariums. It's interesting that as this was happening in the 80s, the zoological community started to take notice. And, you know, the zoos at the time were very much about keepers cleaning and feeding animals in exhibits. But that was about the end of it at the time. But they started taking notice, and with permission from curators and whatnot, and welcomed by veterinarians, keepers at zoological facilities began experimenting with medical behaviors in many of the animals in the zoos, particularly the primates. And it became standard practice with great apes and eventually smaller primates as well to offer their arms for blood sampling, to taking fecal and urine samples. And that has expanded into elephants, into many species in the zoological communities where medical behaviors now are standard practice.
That's great that aquatic medicine has had such an impact on zoological medicine as a whole. Now, I know that one of the key advances that you were part of in the field is diagnostic imaging. How did that get started?
In the early 80s, I used to take veterinarians at Marineland upon request, no charge. We could have people come simply by being willing to show up and work with trainers and work with me, the veterinarian. And so Marineland was a very happening place for training and veterinary students. One veterinary student that came to work with me in 1982 was ultimately my business partner, Ray Stone, young veterinarian whose husband was a equine veterinarian, and his specialty was equine imaging. And in 1982 was when diagnostic ultrasound was just beginning to make the scene in human hospitals as a major diagnostic entity. Ray was able to convince her husband, who was just beginning to do ultrasound in horses, to make ultrasound machines available to try with dolphins at Marineland. Mind you, the ultrasound machines are about the size of a washing machine. It needed six guys to lift it and pluck it over onto a platform in the exhibit where the animals were swimming around. The animals had no problem sliding out, making themselves available. And you'd put this enormous machine out there on the platform and begin doing ultrasound. When I was watching ultrasound back then, I could barely see what the images were showing. It was scratchy kidney. I couldn't even see the kidney. And yet over time, the ultrasound machines became better. Even I could see, and they have since become standard practice in marine parks everywhere. It was through Ray's coming to Marineland and making a project, and she was publishing, speaking to conferences and whatnot, and that was the beginning of diagnostic ultrasound in dolphins.
Going back to some of your original points about preventative medicine and disease evolution, do you think that now, by being able to get routine blood work on your animals and being able to do diagnostic ultrasound, you are actually seeing more issues, more disease processes in these animals, and we're now having to treat them?
Oh, for sure. The more you look, the more you find. For example, the blow simp. We ask the animals to do a chuff. Chuff is a cough. It's not a cough, but it looks and sounds like a cough. I mean, the animal has a very forceful exhalation. You put a sample jar, sample slide, and collect that forced expiration and look at it under a microscope, and you have a rich collection of cellular material there. And you look at that and you see white blood cells, you see parasites, you see epithelial cells, you see all kinds of interesting algae and diatoms and all kinds of stuff. Question is what's normal? What's pathologic? White cells, are they all pathologic? Do they all determine and indicate some pathologic process? And the answer to that is no. With a lot of these medical behaviors, now that we're able to collect samples anytime we want and make a record, a lifetime record of those procedures with animals, the animals themselves create a standard, a norm for that animal. We have to evaluate the results based on a number of things, based on the animal's past history, and we have to establish ratios of certain cells to white cells. For example, we do a ratio of epithelial cells. These are squamous epithelial cells from a blow sample, from the sinus, from the blowhole, from the upper airways, and white cells. And if we find that normal in a sample is equal ratio of white cells to epithelial cells, fine. When then does a sample like that become indicative of a inflammatory process going on? And that is when the ratio of white cells to epithelial cells is greater than one. So if you have twice as many white cells or three times as many white cells as epithelial cells, then we know that somewhere in the respiratory tract, there's inflammation. Then the question becomes, where's the inflammation at? So we have then to know that there is another location in the respiratory tract, the pterygoid sinus. These are equivalent to the sinuses that we have or that dogs and cats have in their nose. And those sinuses are very much subject to low-grade and localized inflammatory processes. When the inflammation is there, they produce a lot of white cells, a lot of transient cells, and parasites, protozoans, are normally found in such samples. So evaluating a blow sample like that, important to be able to distinguish between inflammation in the pterygoid sinus to inflammation in the respiratory tract itself, the bronchi or the blowhole. This is a challenge that we are able, looking at the animal's history, make a diagnostic appraisal of where the sample is from and what cells are predominant in the samples. So medical behaviors are terrific in providing opportunities for samples, but we need to recognize that we're seeing more samples nowadays than we did back in the old days. And therefore, we have to be careful on how we determine the relevance of the findings in many of these medical behavior samples.
This has been such a great overview of your history. Now, let's transition to talking about where you are today.
So let's talk about what we're doing at Dolphin Quest and have done since the early 1990s and up to the present time. And that is recognizing that the social environment is very important for these animals. And we've found at many places, including Dolphin Quest, that the trainers, when on the water with the animals, can form relationships with animals and are actually part of the social environment. That relationship can be put to healthcare benefit of the animals if we recruit dolphin trainers as part of our medical team. At Dolphin Quest, we have what we call daily dolphin assessment, DDAs. DDAs are something that trainers at our facilities do every day. When they come down in the morning, say hello to the animals, give them their vitamins. Each animal is examined by the trainer or trainers, and an assessment is made as to their physical status, their receptivity, their social activity in the environment, the brightness of their eyes. That is followed up by a DDA report, which the trainers send out to our veterinary team every day before noon of that day. Now, this is important in an early diagnosis scenario because trainers know their animals far better than anybody else. They pick up early alterations to the animal's physical presence. This shows up in the DDA. And if by noon the animal is judged to be a little bit off, we are able, through medical behaviors, to institute a full cytological examination. This allows us to pick up early signs of all kinds of possible disease situations. With that information, we are able to change the social context, change the diet, add medications, and do whatever further diagnostic sampling is appropriate. This is early diagnosis at its most efficient and most effective. We've taken this issue one step further at Dolphin Quest. In veterinary offices, veterinarians have incorporated veterinary technicians into their medical program. Veterinary technicians are specifically trained and licensed. They are assistants to the veterinarian. They are able to take samples, to administer medications, assist in surgeries and other procedures, and they are a vital part of a veterinary program. We have taken the veterinary technician opportunity to a slightly different level. We have trained certain individuals of our training staff as veterinary technicians specifically for the cetaceans they're working with. That means that they are able to draw blood samples, they're able to collect urine samples, fecal samples, blow samples, and they're able to read them cytologically. They're good cytologists. They are asked to provide the data, the results of those exams to the veterinarian, who then can evaluate the samples. So the vet techs aren't making diagnoses. They are providing the diagnostic materials to the veterinarians, myself and our local veterinarians, to render the significance of the samples. Our vet techs are doing ultrasound. They're very good at ultrasound. Consider that the ultrasound machine is sitting there on a shelf, and if it waits for the veterinarian to come do an ultrasound exam, that machine may not be used for some days or weeks. In our case, with the trainer slash vet techs capable and very good and efficient at doing ultrasound of the stomach, of kidneys, of lungs, they are doing so on a weekly basis if we elect to do so. And so, again, the frequency of sampling and the quality of sampling is upgraded by having trainers who know the animals so well be able to do the diagnostic procedures and supply that data to the veterinarian on a daily basis. This is early diagnosis at its most optimum. And the result has been, in our animal population, a very positive longevity. Our animals are living longer. So again, in a animal management program where we are encouraging social participation of our staff with the animals. We have our staff, certain of them trained as vet techs. They can do sampling when we need them to, and they do a good job of it. We have survivorship of births in our system greater than 90%, and this is way higher than we know in the wild, our experiences in the past.
Well, first off, congratulations. That's some amazing work you're doing there. As someone who is one of the founders of this field and diagnostic workups, what advice do you have for the folks entering the field today?
I think the key here is that there has to be a direct line of communication on a daily basis from the trainer who notes something amiss in their animal up the chain to the veterinarian, however complex that chain is. And it has to be momentary. To be effective in early diagnosis, you have to be early. The symptoms that are available and recognizable to trainers who know them, they know everything about every movement they make. And when the movement is amiss, they know it and they communicate it upwards. And the result is a diagnostic workup. And that's the system that I'm describing. Our spin on it is that we train our trainers to also be vet tech. We condense the whole system into a very compact unit. But the idea of a team, of real team play, is the same.
I couldn't have said it better myself. High quality patient care, teamwork, doing early diagnostics to get preventative care and better, healthier animals. Jay, thank you so much for being on Aquadocs.
You're very welcome.
And that's going to do it for this week's episode of Aquadocs. I'd like to thank Dr. Jay Sweeney for being on the show this week, as well as all of you, our wonderful listeners, for tuning in. Thank you to our sponsors, AAFE, the American Association of Fish Veterinarians, WAVMA, the World Aquatic Veterinary Medical Association, and the Cornell Wildlife Health Center for their continued support of Aquadocs. As always, check out our Facebook and Instagram to stay up to date on the latest Aquadocs news. And if you've got an extra moment, please like and follow us on Apple and Spotify and leave a review. I'm Michelle Greenfield-Feig. We'll see you next time here on Aquadocs.